It is Monday, February 4th, 2013. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas. Support for KUAF comes from Serta Pro Painters, serving residential and commercial clients with interior and exterior painting and interior design, deck and fence staining, and specialty finishes. Locally owned and operated by Aaron Lewis. Estimates and information available at 1-800-GO-CERTA or certapro.com. Ahead on Ozarks, an initiative at the U of A School of Law to help Native American tribes with their food and agriculture ventures. An evening of Jewish art and music. Plus, the overwintering habits of bugs. But first, an audit set to be released Friday that was expected to show instances of waste in the state's Medicaid program is now being held until at least this week. The audit's release was first mentioned in a legislative joint auditing committee Wednesday. Spokesman Matt DeCampbell says the governor had some worries about the way the audit was conducted, and the Department of Human Services and the Division of Legislative Audit have been going back and forth over the audit's findings.
In the past few days, and especially today, there's been some good, constructive, positive meetings between DHS and legislative audit staff, and it now appears that audit will not be released on Friday, but instead will come out, I assume, sometime next week.
The audit was originally expected to be released in March. The legislature needs to provide its approval before a large steel mill can be brought to East Arkansas. A meeting will be held on Wednesday for Governor Mike Beebe to answer questions from lawmakers. In his weekly radio address, Beebe said Big River Steel plans to build a $1.1 billion mill near Osceola. It will employ 525 people.
Before this deal is finalized, the legislature must approve the project. In 2004, Arkansas voters gave legislators authority to issue bonds to help attract large-scale economic development projects. Legislative leaders will ensure that all due diligence and reviews are executed. Many in the General Assembly have expressed their excitement about this project's implications for our state.
As the governor and state economic development officials work to bring the billion-dollar steel plant to the state, legislators are wary to endorse the economic development bonds before they see the details. House Economic Development Committee Chair Matthew Shepard, a Republican from El Dorado, tells Talk Business Arkansas he's happy for the possibility of new jobs, but wants to see the details first.
I haven't seen any of the specifics, really, of what the proposal is. Once we get those, then I think we'll be in a better position to, obviously, to vet the proposal, but also look at what, if any, options are available. But again, it's a positive development.
The governor will meet with House and Senate legislators in Committee of the Whole meetings to provide more specifics on the deal. The governor has said lawmakers will need to approve $125 million in bonds to land the project. The Army Corps of Engineers has concluded its annual count of bald eagles on Beaver Lake. It appears that more eagles are calling the lake home this winter than this time last year. But while the year's count was up from last year's total of 120 eagles, Lake Operations Manager Sean Harper says the annual count is merely a snapshot of eagles on the lake at a given point in time.
There's always going to be variation in numbers. I wouldn't read anything into it in terms of whether it's up or down from the previous year. That's a good, healthy 175 bald eagles is right in the middle, if you will, of what we normally count. So we feel pretty good that that's about what we normally expect on an eagle count survey. So I would think that we would say that that's right in line with normal eagle type presence on Beaver Lake for this time of year. But there's always going to be variations. Some years you just might happen to be in the particular cove where there's 20 or 30 that just may happen to be roosting in that cove at that moment. So the count may be up a little bit because of just you happen to be very fortunate in picking the right cove at the right time.
Harper says that there are enough eagles at the lake right now for casual users to spot one of the birds.
We actually get a lot of information from lake users that give us a call or maybe send us an email that they spotted eagles when they were out on the lake. I would think it'd be quite likely if you were going up and down the lake, particularly if you were going up into some of the coves on the lake, that you would see an eagle, particularly, on the north end of the lake, more so than the south end.
Officials with the Army Corps of Engineers conducted the annual eagle count over a two-day period in early January. Of the 175 bald eagles counted, 153 were adults and 22 were immature. Ground is set to be broken this afternoon on a much-anticipated highway construction project in Fayetteville. The groundbreaking ceremony for the Highway 71B flyover will be held at 2 p.m. behind the Red Robin restaurant on Van Ash Drive. City engineer Chris Brown says that the project will help alleviate a traffic headache that has plagued drivers for years.
Right now, we have a lot of folks who are coming down College Avenue who want to make a left turn onto Joyce, go into the major shopping area, the mall area. Also, at the same time, those left turners, some of them, about 25% of those left turners, are actually making a U-turn to get onto the Fulbright Expressway. Then we have the traffic coming off of the Fulbright Expressway onto College Avenue. Many of them want to go right on Joyce, and so you have your classic weaving situation where you have cars on one side that want to go to the left and the cars on the other side want to go to the right, and it's very congested and there are lots of accidents right at that intersection.
The project is expected to be complete sometime in 2014. It's 80% funded by a federal earmark from the 2005 highway bill. The remaining 20% will be paid by the city from its transportation bond fund. The 19th annual Game for Life blood drive takes place this week. According to a release by the University of Arkansas, the annual blood drive benefiting the Community Blood Center of the Ozarks celebrates both Razorback basketball and life-saving efforts of area blood donors. This year, Arkansas fans will compete for more donors than fans of the University of Tennessee and Medic Blood Center. Those wishing to donate blood can do so at three sites, including one at 3503 South Thompson in Springdale, 1400 Southeast Watton Walton Boulevard in Bentonville, and at Willard J. Walker Hall on the U of A campus in Fayetteville. Donors will receive a free t-shirt and free pizza from Papa John's. The blood drive starts today and runs through the end of the week. This event is reportedly the Community Blood Center of the Ozarks' largest Arkansas area blood drive. There's forecast calls for chance for showers and thunderstorms before 7 p.m. with a low of 29 in northwest Arkansas. Partly cloudy with a low of 39 in the Arkansas River Valley. Tomorrow, Tuesday, sunny with highs in the low to mid-60s. Tuesday night, mostly clear with lows from 30 in northwest Arkansas to 38 in the River Valley.
I'm Roby Brock. A billion-dollar super project is coming to Arkansas, as is a New York technology firm. Arkansas landed its first official super project as Big River Steel announced plans to construct a $1.1 billion steel mill in Mississippi County near Osceola. The mill will employ 525 workers initially, with average annual wages of $75,000. More than double the state's per capita income. A quick study of the potential long-term economic impact of the planned steel mill suggests that the operation could eventually boost Arkansas's GDP by $236 million a year, according to an economic impact study performed by UALR researcher Gregory Hamilton. Internet marketer and technology firm Inuvo is moving its corporate headquarters from New York to Conway and adding 50 new jobs over the next 4 years. The company said that senior leaders have committed personally to the move. Inuvo develops consumer applications for the internet and delivers targeted advertisements onto websites owned by partners and the company. In 2012, it reported revenues of $53 million. A $138 million funding gap in the state's Medicaid program has shrunk to $61 million, according to state officials. Governor Mike Beebe and the Arkansas Department of Human Services disclosed the improved financial scenario just one day before an expected damaging audit was released on the state Medicaid program. DHS Director John Selig said the improved budget situation meant potential cuts to Level 3 nursing home care and three other programs would be avoided. The earnings season hit Arkansas. Murphy Oil posted a big turnaround in its fourth quarter earnings as the El Dorado-based oil and gas firm prepares to divide its company in two. Murphy Oil announced net income of $158 million compared to a net loss of about $114 million in the previous year's fourth quarter. A storm-impacted fourth quarter did not help Arkansas Best Corporation's bottom line. The Fort Smith-based freight hauler posted a $7.9 million quarterly loss compared to a $1.4 million profit 1 year ago. For the full year, Arkansas Best ended with a $7.7 million loss, after turning a $6.2 million profit in 2011. Company officials said Hurricane Sandy's disruption of commerce along the eastern seaboard was partially to blame. USA Truck added another quarter of pain to its 2012 financial performance. The Van Buren-based trucking firm posted a $3.1 million loss in the fourth quarter to bring its full-year losses to more than $17.5 million. Despite declining revenue, database marketer Axiom posted higher earnings in its third quarter. The Little Rock-based firm reported net income of $14.5 million compared to $7.9 million 1 year ago. And Power Technology has acquired the business of ClassTech, a German-based laser manufacturing operation. Terms of the private transaction were not disclosed. Little Rock-based Power Technology is a global leader in laser manufacturing. I'm Roby Brock, and that is your Talk Business Update.
Support for Talk Business on Ozarks at Large is provided by Bank of the Ozarks. Committed to helping business owners succeed by combining the tools and services businesses need with accessible experience and knowledge. Bank of the Ozarks, you have a friend here. This is Ozarks at Large. For over 30 years, the University of Arkansas School of Law has had the only graduate agriculture and food law program in the nation. And until now, there has not been a program in the nation that focuses on tribal food systems, agriculture, and sustainability issues. Last month, the U of A Law School launched the Indigenous Food and Agriculture Initiative. This initiative is led by two Native American women and lawyers. Dean of the School of Law, Stacy Leeds, is the only Native American law school dean in the country. She is joined by Janie Sims Hip, graduate of the U of A Law School's Agriculture LLM program. She leaves her post as Senior Advisor for Tribal Relations at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Dean Leeds and Ms. Hip recently stopped by the KUAF studios. Hip began our conversation by explaining the need for such an initiative, stating that there are 566 federally recognized tribes in the U.S. at various locations all around the country, with 220 in Alaska alone. Many of those tribes have had long-term food and agribusiness interests, but there is a growing number of tribes who are investing in food and agribusinesses or ramping up the ones they already have, as well as starting new. Here's Hip.
And so the need for really an intense approach to strategic business planning, the governance structures around those tribal food and ag businesses, just that whole body of technical assistance and strategic thought, and then implementation around governance and building out the professionals within Indian country writ large, who have those skills around sustainable, long-term health and growth in the food sector. That's where the needs truly are.
So you mentioned that there's kind of a recent increase in tribal interest in food business. What are the reasons for this recent increase? I know there's also more focused interest on local foods and, the small farmer as opposed to the large farmer, you know, just kind of nationally as well as locally. Is that one of the reasons why there's this recent increase?
It is. Tribal communities have the same needs and wants as any other local community. And so just as the local food movement has taken on across the United States, it's happening within tribal communities as well. But the other thing at play is that tribal governments are really coming into their own in a way where they have the infrastructure and the education and the capacity to govern themselves at the local level. And so tribes have spent the last few decades basically reestablishing their governance structures. So this is the next step that we see emerging in Indian country. Tribes are looking for various ways to diversify their economies. They're becoming more and more global players in terms of marketplace. And it's a pretty special time where we thought this initiative would be ideal to help.
I've heard you use the term business and economy and economic, and then also agriculture. So how does this fit into the law school as opposed to maybe the business school or the agriculture school?
One of the first decisions you need to make as an agricultural producer, or if you're thinking of having, say, a value-added, local regional food business, is what kind of business structure do you conduct your business within? Is it an LLC? Is it a corporation? Are you a member of a cooperative? All of those are legal structures. And so understanding the differences between those legal structures allows you to think about your business entity in a very deliberate way. And so understanding how the tribal governance piece intersects with the business entity decision-making process, and then how do you fill out the other needs for business-related skills, which all weave in and out of legal issues all the time. But there's a growing number of tribes are in export markets, which is a whole nother level of legal issues that tribes need to think about.
I mean, exporting just from state to state? Or
no,
there are
tribes that export their food products to Asia, to Japan, to China, to all over the Pacific Rim. There are tribes that export their food products into Europe already. And so it's very, very exciting. Lots of opportunities.
And what I was going to add is the very nature of food and agriculture is probably one of the most interdisciplinary areas that we would have at the University of Arkansas across the campus. But particularly when you deal with tribes, the legal complexities touch everything that a tribe could possibly do. And to give you an example of that, to build on what Janie said, tribes are still very natural resource rich and predominantly land-based. And at present, when an Indian farmer wants to go out and make use of their land, because of the federal laws tied up with tribal land, it's not as simple as that farmer having complete control over their land. And so federal law comes into play, tribal law comes into play, and in some situations, you have all three sovereigns with the ability to regulate something to do with that land. And so it's just one of those examples where programs that we could provide as an educational opportunity for our law students, be they in our JD program or the LLM, it presents one of the more complex legal structures that we could expose them to.
Okay. Well, you've done a pretty good job of telling me how it fits in to the law school. And you did mention that the University of Arkansas Law School has one of the oldest Agri LLM programs, right?
The only.
The only agriculture. Okay, pardon me. Thank you. So that kind of answers my next question. But you mentioned earlier that over 200 of the nation's tribes live in Alaska. And so here we are really, really, really far away from Alaska. The other 300 tribes are just kind of scattered across the rest of the United States. So how does this fit into the University of Arkansas?
Well, one of the ways it fits in very, very well is that we sit right next to Oklahoma, which has over 30 federally recognized tribes. And so there are a lot of Native students who already come to the University of Arkansas, Fayetteville, for their bachelor's, master's, PhD work already. And obviously that, we have, this university has had a long connection with the tribes in Oklahoma anyway, during Arkansas Territory time period, way before any of us were born. many of the removed tribes from the southeast actually found their home within Arkansas during Arkansas Territory days before final removal into what would eventually become Oklahoma. And so this campus has a long connection with all of the tribes in Oklahoma. And so, but the connection that you can make with, all the Alaska tribes is very easy to do with distance education. A lot of the tribes that live very remotely, but they also have an infrastructure of distance capacities, distance learning. There are even some tribes in very remote villages there who have their pharmaceuticals delivered electronically.
Okay.
Which is pretty amazing.
Well, I wanted to ask about field trips to Alaska. But
we kind of do that too.
And I think two points that I would add to that. I really view this region of the country as Northwest Arkansas and Northeastern Oklahoma as economic partners together. The other point is that, you know, University of Arkansas has been known across the globe because of Senator Fulbright and others as being a place that we train our students for their success throughout the world. And, you know, we certainly can do that through a number of international initiatives. But here's a way to expose our students, particularly the law students, to something similar to an international market. They're going to interact with a different sovereign that has a different set of rules. And we can replicate that with our interactions with a tribe with an hour or two drive into Arkansas, as opposed to a six-week study abroad somewhere. And so I really just see it part of our, you know, entire international mission.
What is the first thing that you'd like to accomplish?
Well, something that's happened even in the first 24 to 48 hours after we made this, announcement. At this point, we've had the luxury of not having to pick up the phone and build those bridges, but there's so much excitement in Indian country about this project that tribes and organizations and entities across the country have been calling us saying, how can we partner? How can we have you be a part of our initiative? So deciding up front exactly what our priorities of partnership will be the early legwork, because the opportunities are just endless.
There might be too many.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, that was going to be a question too. What kind of response have you seen from the tribal community? But it sounds like it's pretty good and supportive.
It is, yeah. And it's such a hot topic right now.
Well, in fact, I was on the phone right before we left to come here with the Center for Native American Youth, the national FFA organization. They were meeting together for the first time, and I was talking with them because youth are a huge piece of both of their efforts to build the next generation of leaders.
And a couple of inquiries that I've received in the last few days take us in a slightly different direction, but certainly within the realm of things that we would consider working on. There's the tribal business piece of this, but there's also the traditional indigenous knowledge about seeds and plant life and environmental issues. And, you know, there's already been some requests of, can you help X community put a plan together for how they can disseminate knowledge that they might not want to share in the public immediately, but how to manage that intellectual property. Then there's intrinsically legal issues tied up with all of that as well.
All right. What else, ladies? Anything?
The only other thing that I think that we've missed out of talking about is food and ag necessarily ties to nutrition and health and wellness.
Yep.
And another reason of why this, why now, is just like there's obesity and diabetes epidemic across the country nationally, it particularly hits hard in Indian country. And so both of our careers have seen communities that are just devastated because of lack of good food in the community, lack of accessible and affordable good foods in the community. And it certainly would be remiss if we didn't talk about nutrition and what the potential health impacts of a fully well-developed plan of food and agriculture in a community could be.
Okay.
But the food and nutrition piece, the nutrition and healthy eating, is very much on folks' minds when you're dealing with diabetes at the highest levels that it is within Native populations. Then you have to, by definition, think about what it is we're eating and how do we improve that. And so it all comes back into what we're doing here, I think.
And it is just like everywhere else or any other community.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Thank you, ladies.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks.
Stacy Leeds is dean of the U of A Law School. Janie Sims Hip is heading up the Tribal Initiative. They recently joined me at the KUAF studios. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas. Summer in the Ozarks means long days spent with wasps, flies, and butterflies buzzing around, and warm nights spent with the chirping of katydids and crickets. As winter approaches and the days grow shorter, you may notice that the nights become quieter. Where do these insects spend a long winter? As it turns out, many do like we humans do, hibernating inside our homes, cocooned under layers of clothing and blankets. To learn more, I travel to Owl Hollow Road in West Fork, where Dr. Donald Steinkraus, entomologist at the University of Arkansas and Ozarks at Large's insect expert, has some land. On a cold but sunny winter's day last month, Dr. Steinkraus pointed out something on a tree that on any other day I would have walked right past.
The insects have many strategies for surviving the winter, and I'll show you one right now.
Okay.
This is a small crabapple tree I planted a few years ago. And if you notice on here on this branch, what do you see?
It's some sparkly goopy stuff.
Very good. No, this is the egg mass of a tent caterpillar moth.
You'll see tent caterpillars inside silken tents in the crotches of certain trees in early spring. The tents are meant to protect them from birds. I know I opened them as a young girl to find hundreds of the fuzzy caterpillars. This particular moth survives the winter as an egg mass, the greenish sparkly stuff we found on this tree. Steinkraus says this was probably actually laid last May or early June.
And it's covered with a special type of material called spumaline, and it's hygroscopic, and it absorbs moisture and keeps the eggs from drying out. And then in this early spring, before this plant really hardly leaves out at all, these little caterpillars will hatch out, start spinning silk, and live communally. And the problem with these things, these are actually kind of a pest, even though they're native, is they'll completely defoliate a tree like this. So after we're done talking, I'm going to remove these egg masses. I don't want them to defoliate my little tree.
This is an example of one overwintering strategy as eggs, protected someplace. A common strategy for a lot of insects. If you log on to ozarksatlarge.com, you'll find a picture of these egg masses. There were two of them, in between which I pointed out a ladybug.
So you noticed a ladybird beetle there, a coccinellid, right?
Okay.
Okay, they overwinter as adults usually, and usually hibernate in cracks in bark, in groups or in houses. So they seek like a kind of a warm place where they can get out of the wind and cold, and they survive as an adult. And as it warms up, they'll come out and start foraging and laying eggs and mating.
I have also noticed some ladybugs hanging out in my kitchen of late. Steinkraus says they're mistaking my house for a giant tree. We move on.
Oh, okay, now here's an interesting thing. If you see that tree there, that's a pignut hickory, which is a native hickory. And if we go underneath that hickory, or any of the hickories right now, you'll find these branches. Now, what does that look like to you?
Well, I mean, it kind of looks like something's eating around it.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. It's almost like it's not like a ripped cut. And this is called by a cerambycid beetle, or longhorn beetle, called a hickory twig girdler.
The adult female beetle, in the summertime, chewed around the twig and laid an egg somewhere inside that twig. The twigs fall down, providing a suitable habitat for the larvae to survive the winter. In the springtime, a beetle will emerge. When picking up sticks in my yard, I never imagined that they were housing a baby critter. Steinkraus considers them a bit of a nuisance and will pick up the approximately 2 feet long twigs. In fact, he has a pile of them, all similarly sized, all with the same pattern of perfectly shaped marks, almost like a sharpened pencil. The twig girdler uses her mandibles, specialized jaws, to separate the twigs from their trees. Soon, Steinkraus will burn them, killing the larvae, but saving his hickory trees.
The cerambycids are an interesting group of beetles, and really beautiful, a lot of them, but they almost all are adapted to living in wood as larvae, I suppose all of them are. So right now, in all kinds of dead trees around here, or dying trees, there are larvae of wood-boring beetles, like buprestids and cerambycids. So that's another way they survive, as larvae under the trunks of in the wood.
We continue our trek through the small pasture, walking toward a slight hill that heads into the woods.
Well, here's a young persimmon tree in the pasture. And what do you see on here?
Yeah, there's something. It looks cocoony maybe almost.
Well, these are the egg masses of praying mantids, which are living out here in the field. So right now, if you searched around, you would not find any adult praying mantids or any nymphal ones. All the praying mantid population would be in this stage as eggs. And like the tent caterpillar egg mass, it's covered with a froth. Why don't you feel it?
It looks different, though. While the tent caterpillar looks like some substance sprayed around the branch, the praying mantis egg mass really looks like a cocoon, a couple of inches long. If you opened it up, inside would be the eggs of the praying mantis, which will hatch in the spring, making baby praying mantis. They'll run around, eat things, shed their skin, grow wings, and make adult praying mantises who will, again, lay eggs. Coat it with a protective layer, and the cycle will start again.
Well, before we go up in the woods, if you look at this pasture here, in the summer and fall, there'd be many, many different species of grasshoppers here. This is a very rich area in grasshoppers and also crickets. And almost all the grasshoppers and crickets lay their eggs in the soil. So their life cycle also involves, like the mantid and the tent caterpillar, they survive the winter by putting their eggs deep in the soil. So right now, if we dug around in here enough, we could probably find egg masses of various species of grasshoppers and crickets.
Also in the soil are things like grubs, May beetles, June beetles, Japanese beetles, all in the grub stage. The dirt providing the protection they need to survive the winter and emerge in the spring.
Okay, another important insect group which we could talk about are the katydids. Mm-hmm. You know what a katydid is?
Yes.
Well, sort of a greenish.
Right, with the big kind of tail.
Yeah.
Well, not really a tail, but they're kind of flat and, right?
Yeah, they have often have an ovipositor on their end, the females do. And they look like leaves, but they're an important part of the sort of summertime sounds of nature in Arkansas, because they sing up in the trees during the nighttime. There's different types of katydids, and they make these very loud songs to attract mates. And all of them would not be existing as adults right now. They lay their eggs usually in twigs themselves. So they have specialized ovipositors, which are called an egg-laying device, and they can sort of saw a slit in a twig and lay their eggs in the twig.
So that's the stage of the katydid. They too will emerge in the spring, molt, mate, and do the same thing all over again. Walking sticks also survive the winter as eggs. If you looked for an adult walking stick, you wouldn't find any live ones right now. They just drop their eggs into the leaf litter, a large egg that survives the winter underneath a bed of leaves.
So let's talk about another stage that insects overwinter as, and that's as pupae or chrysalises. Do you know what that stage is, a pupa?
I mean, would that be like in a cocoon and not an
yes.
egg, so they've graduated a little bit?
Right, right. So the whole metabolous insects, the complete metamorphosis.
The life cycle of most insects begins with the egg, larvae, pupae, and finally, the adult stage. In the pupae stage, they are reorganizing their tissues from larval stage, a caterpillar, to an adult stage, one with wings and different mouth parts. In Arkansas, we are blessed with a lot of butterflies, as well as moths. Adult butterflies and moths lay eggs on leaves of certain trees and plants. These larvae feed on the leaves throughout the summer, forming into pupae, or a chrysalis, in the fall. Many moths, as larvae, spin silk cocoons to live in throughout the winter, like the cocoon of the Cecropia moth that we stumble upon. The Cecropia moth is often called the robin moth because of the brown and orange-colored wings, much like the bird.
So the larva, in this case, this is a Cecropia moth cocoon, and the larva fed up in this tree. And I think this is an elm, and it ate the leaves, and then it came down and it spun its cocoon out of silk, which it produces from its silk glands. So why don't you touch that? It's really quite amazingly strong structure.
If we opened this silk cocoon up, we'd find a smooth brown object inside, with the outline of wings, legs, antennae, and abdomen. But inside it would be mush, because it's reorganizing. And right now, the pupae is probably in complete diapause.
Many insects prevent themselves from freezing totally by having glycerol, which is an alcohol, in their body, like antifreeze, which prevents them from freezing solid and breaking their cells. So if you open this up, there would be this chrysalis in there, or pupa, and in the spring it'll emerge as an adult. And then, you know, it'll hang on this tree, it expands its wings. When they're hard, it'll fly off and seek a mate. And then after they mate, it will, the female will fly off and lay her eggs and start to cycle over.
One butterfly we are all familiar with is the monarch. Monarchs migrate for the winter. Much like geese flying south, monarchs head to Mexico. Some insects live out the winter as adults, like wasps. The wasp nests that were filled in the summer are empty and now safe to handle. It's a good time to clean up your porches. The adult wasps are hiding, under bark, inside a dead tree, or the siding of a house. And one other way that insects survive is in streams or rivers. Aquatic insects, like dragonflies, live out the winter dormant as nymphs. Tis the cycle of life. Dr. Steinkraus is an entomologist at the U of A and Ozarks at Large's insect expert.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkan Songs. Not much is known about the life of blues performer Alec Rice Miller, better known as Sonny Boy Williamson II. Even in old age, he offered several birth dates. In the mid-1960s, when he finally became a popular musician worldwide, he was known for onstage dancing, playing harmonica with no hands or with his nose. His known recordings are from the last 14 years of his life and are considered classics of the genre. But Williamson's legacy may be as a writer. His songs have been interpreted by an incredible array of artists in and outside of the blues. 3 decades later, the Blues Brothers covered one of Williamson's earliest known recordings from the early 1950s from Jackson, Mississippi's Trumpet label, heard at the opening and called From the Bottom. Years before Sonny Boy Williamson became a recording star, he'd been a radio star in the 1940s. He could be heard on KFFA in Helena's groundbreaking King Biscuit Time program and promoting How to Call Cough Syrup on West Memphis, Arkansas's KWEM. By the early 1960s, only about 2 years before his death, the Phillips County resident had become an international star by headlining package tours in Europe. Williams was so well-liked overseas, he extended his stay to play more festival and club dates, and he even began wearing English suits and bowler hats to complement his briefcase of harmonicas. Williamson also recorded with blues-influenced Britons like Jimmy Page and Eric Clapton in the Yardbirds. He's heard here with Eric Burdon and the Animals from a December 1963 concert. Through the decade, these emerging British rock bands would help repopularize interest in the blues, and Sonny Boy's songs would remain in the public ears as well.
I got to find out what's going down, checking up on my baby. And you know that Bobo got to find out what's going down. So many nights and days, people, city blues happen in my town.
Williamson could be known to throw together sloppy blues verses even in the studio, but his best song titles could read like poetry: Fattening Frogs for Snakes, Eyesight to the Blind, Your Funeral in My Trial. Besides, by the time he had recorded for Chess, he was likely in his late 60s at the least. Williamson had played with Robert Johnson and Phillips County native Robert Nighthawk in the 1930s. He'd given a young Howlin' Wolf harmonica lessons, and now Wolf recorded on Chess as well. One might expect songs written by an influential blues harmonica player to endure among blues interpreters like Taj Mahal. He's heard here from 1968, doing Sonny Boy Williamson's Checkin' Up on My Baby from the Rolling Stones movie Rock and Roll Circus. Aerosmith, Can't Eat, and Peter Green's Fleetwood Mac have covered Sonny Boy Williamson songs. So did the Moody Blues. Eric Clapton did a version of Eyesight to the Blind for Tommy, The Who's movie about a deaf, dumb, and blind boy, and The Who cut its own version, too. It's the only covered song found in The Who's rock opera.
You talk about your woman, I wish you could see mine. Yeah, you talk about your woman, I wish you could see mine. Every time she starts to love me, she brings eyesight to the blind.
Williamson's songs have often transcended the genre in which they were written. Of course, blues revival acts like Canned Heat and Fleetwood Mac covered them, but so did R&B's Solomon Burke and the New York Dolls. Mose Allison did Williamson with a jazz flair in the 1950s and 60s, while Bob Dylan stole the line Nine Below Zero. Led Zeppelin stole Sonny Boy Williamson's Bring It On Home, but Willie Dixon wrote that one. In 1992, Bruce Springsteen added lyrics and interpreted Williamson's Cross My Heart as a pop song on Springsteen's first album after the breakup of the E Street Band.
First time I crossed my heart, I was begging, baby, please. At your bedside, down on my knees when I crossed my heart. It's when I crossed my heart. I crossed my heart, pretty baby, over you.
When Williamson returned to the U.S. just weeks before his death, some of his friends in Arkansas and Mississippi reportedly didn't believe he had ever been in Europe, much less that he'd been in the toast of the town wherever he went. After playing across the globe, Williamson came home to die, an event he had predicted. He was right. After several weeks of making the rounds, visiting old friends, and fishing, Williamson died in Helena on May 25, 1965. Williamson's recordings and his songs continue to influence popular music today and are listened to worldwide. Here's one of the earlier attempts at interpretation of a song by Arkansas-er Sonny Boy Williamson of Helena. It's Mose Allison, recorded in 1959, covering Eyesight to the Blind.
You're talking about your woman, I wish you could see mine. You're talking about your woman, I wish you could see mine. Every time I start loving, she bring eyesight to the blind. I know her daddy got some money, I can tell by the way she walk. I know her daddy got some money, I can tell by the way she walk. Every time she started shaking, them don't begin to talk. She was lying on the bed, Malik's door was dying, raised up his head and said, ain't she pretty? Don't you know she fine? One look at that woman bring eyesight to the blind. I declare she pretty and the whole state knows she fine. I declare she pretty and the whole state knows she fine. Every time she start loving, she bring eyesight to the blind.
From 1959, Mose Allison's version of Eyesight to the Blind, written by Alec Rice Miller, or Sonny Boy Williamson II of Helena. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of FM 89 and Experiment Station Studios. For more information, visit arkansongs.org.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas. Dr. Richard Sun is a history professor at the University of Arkansas, specializing in modern French history and European social, cultural, and intellectual history. Growing up in Chicago and spending time at the Art Institute led Sun to find Impressionist art. Tomorrow evening on the University of Arkansas campus, Sun will lead an evening of Jewish music and art. His lecture will explore the roots and legacy of Jewish art in the 20th century. While researching a book, Dr. Sun discovered that after the Bolshevik Revolution of the 1920s, many anarchists fled to Paris. Many of them were Jewish. He began our conversation with another discovery.
I discovered that in the left bank artist colony of Montparnasse, which was the major art center in the 1920s, there were an extraordinary number of these immigrant Jews who'd come to Paris and to Montparnasse to become artists. In fact, there were hundreds, which seemed extraordinary to me.
And just because they had fled other areas of Europe. And
well, they had fled, or this was the period between 1880 and 1920 of huge Jewish emigration out of mostly Russia or the Russian Empire, which included then Poland, Bielorussia, Ukraine. And so these people were not so much fleeing as looking for opportunities to become artists, and for them that meant Paris. And this huge period of Jewish emigration, in which probably 3 million Jews left Eastern Europe and came to New York, to London, mm-hmm. to Paris, especially to New York, of course.
Right.
Coincided with the era that we call modernism and the arts. Just so happened, they happened to coincide with that perfectly, and most of them arrived in Paris before World War I, between 1905 and 1914. I'm speaking of, the most famous of them is probably Marc Chagall, Chaim Soutine, Jacques Lipschitz, the sculptor.
Chagall, that sounds like a French name.
Well, many of them, his name was Chagall, mm-hmm. but it would have been Moishe Chagall back in Vitebsk, mm-hmm. in Western or White Russia. So he became Marc Chagall. Jules Pascin, another of these artists, had been Julius Pincus back mm-hmm. in Vadin, Bulgaria. He became Jules Pascin.
Okay, so they changed their names.
Some did. Okay. Chaim Soutine did not, but many of them did change their names. Well, one thing that was so extraordinary about this generation was that, unlike, say, Jewish music, which was already legendary, and there were great Jewish composers like Felix Mendelssohn and plenty of Jewish violinists, there wasn't much tradition of Jewish artists before this period. And suddenly there are hundreds. So it was an extraordinary phenomenon.
Chagall uses a lot of color in his pictures, and Modigliani did not have a lot of color. I mean, they were very different.
They're very different.
Very different.
Right. Modigliani and Pascin were Sephardic Jews. Pascin was from Bulgaria. Modigliani's from Livorno, Italy. And so unlike the Eastern European Jews, who are Ashkenazi Jews and are Yiddish-speaking, which was most of these immigrants, Pascin and Modigliani were the exceptions. They were Sephardic Jews who originally hailed from Spain. And so Modigliani was a very, very assimilated, but also very consciously Jewish artist. He's not thought of as being a Jewish artist, but he was. And he was proud of his Jewish ancestry. And so he arrived in Paris in 1906 and became, one of the most famous of these
His
artists.
Paintings are mostly portraits of women, from what I've seen.
Yes. For a while there, around 1911 to 14 or 15, he thought of himself primarily as a sculptor and did lots of heads. And you can see the influence of his sculptures in the paintings he did subsequently, because they have a kind of sculptural look. And those long noses and long necks, that became his signature in the brief period he painted from 1915 till his premature death at age 35.
I know, I saw that. He was very young.
He died of tuberculosis. Mm-hmm. They look kind of like, they have a sculptural appearance.
Well, for me, out of all the artists that you've mentioned, he's the one that sticks out the most for some reason.
Now, Montparnasse is most famous in the 20s that's the era of Hemingway and Fitzgerald mm-hmm. and Gertrude Stein and all these expatriates. So it was a remarkably cosmopolitan international art scene, probably the most international art scene of all time.
I would have loved
anywhere.
To have been there.
It was a fun place. Yeah. And so Americans think about Hemingway and Fitzgerald. Mm-hmm. Even Woody Allen, who is quite Jewish,
Midnight.
And made that great film Midnight in Paris, I'm sure he does not know that if you had strolled along the Boulevard Montparnasse back then, you would have heard Yiddish spoken along those outdoor cafes, because there were hundreds of these Yiddish-speaking Jewish artists. So I thought it was fascinating. One thing that interests me is that virtually none of them settled in the large Jewish quarters on the right bank in Paris, the area of the Marais or Bellevue, where heavily Jewish neighborhoods. They all chose to live in Montparnasse, where they could interact with other mm-hmm. artists and become artists, not limited to being Jewish.
Right.
So it's a challenge to look at their art and see what is, if anything, is specifically Jewish about their artistic style.
And from what we've discussed, it sounds like Chagall is one of the only ones that, well,
that really focuses on his Jewish heritage.
Right, that's true. Mm-hmm. In a more subtle way, however, someone like Chaim Soutine, who is probably the most expressionist artist painting in Paris, his work looks more like what's happening in Germany at the same time among the German expressionists. And so one thing that might mark Modigliani and Soutine and another number of the other artists is a kind of subjectivity, looking at the individual and portraying a strong sort of inner, bringing out the inner self, the inner person. So not just what they look like on the outside. I think part of their modernism comes from bringing out the inner quality, which I think Jewish music does too. The klezmer music has a kind of subjective, melancholy quality. And so that may be something a little subtler than just painting scenes of the old shtetl life of Eastern Europe, but I think it's there also and might be in some ways recognizably Jewish.
Well, you mentioned the klezmer music.
Yes.
So tomorrow night, it's not just a night of Jewish art, it's also a night of Jewish music. So how is music going to fit in?
Well, we decided to call this an evening of Jewish art and music. Klezmer music has had a huge revival in the last 30 years, and especially New York-based groups like the Klezmatic and the Klezmer Conservatory Band have revived this traditional Ashkenazi Eastern European musical culture. There is a group based in Tulsa, mostly of doctors who call themselves the Klezmeds, and I heard about them, and I'm bringing in a retired physician named David Hurwitz, who plays a clarinet in this group, and he will give a lecture on the origins and traditions of klezmer music and demonstrate it on his clarinet. And then I love music too, and I play the violin or perhaps the fiddle, more appropriately here. And we may join in and jam together a little bit on my fiddle and his clarinet and do some klezmer music, and we'll have a reception and maybe play some music while that reception is going on. So the klezmer music is really fun. It's a wonderful musical genre. And I think we'll go to enhance the sense of this Eastern European Ashkenazi Jewish culture that was so rich before, of course, before the Holocaust.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Sun.
My pleasure.
Dr. Richard Sun is professor of history at the University of Arkansas. He'll speak tomorrow evening at 6 in the Arkansas Student Union for an evening of Jewish music and art. This is part of the Beyond the Holocaust series. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Bentonville, Fort Smith, and Heifel. Today's programming is brought to you in part by our day sponsor, Walt Manger, who says 50 years ago yesterday, three stars fell: Buddy Holly, J.P. Richardson, also known as the Big Bopper, and Richie Valens. They are remembered because the music never died. Arkansas Women's Shelter will host Walk a Mile in Her Shoes, Saturday, March 2nd, beginning at 9 a.m. at the Bentonville High School track. This fundraising relay and march will feature all participants in high heel shoes to show support for victims of domestic violence. Registration and more information are available at walkamilenwa.com. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Christina Thomas. Kyle Kellums and Antoinette Grajeda will be back tomorrow for an all-new daily edition of Ozarks at Large. Thank you so much for listening, and happy Monday.